From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's easy to talk about the implications of population, but it's always dicey to talk about what you do about it. The ethics of population is complicated, but there have been a number of recent books that have taken on the issue. In the latest edition of The New Yorker magazine, the journalist Elizabeth Colbert breaks down some of the arguments for and against having children. Among the perspectives is one that challenges the idea that childbearing is a natural urge that must be acted upon. One writer suggests that having kids just to benefit yourself is a moral error. But there's also the idea that self-interest isn't a bad way to look at having children, and that if you did weigh the costs and sacrifices of kids, you'd probably have more. Today in the program, Elizabeth Colbert is among our guests to raise the question, is procreation immoral? Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In about 13 years, the global population is expected to add another billion people, 8 billion by 2025. There are all kinds of implications to this kind of growth, but what about the ethics of it all, the ethics of having kids? That's harder to talk about. Recently, though, there have been a number of books that have taken up the question. In the latest edition of The New Yorker magazine, the journalist Elizabeth Colbert breaks down some of those arguments. Among them is this idea that childbearing isn't really natural, that it can be selfish, even immoral. But also there's the idea that if you weighed the real costs and the true sacrifices of having kids, you would have more. Elizabeth Colbert is among our guests today to raise the question in her article, Is Procreation Immoral? We invite you to join the conversation. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Elizabeth Colbert is an environmental journalist, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. Her piece, The Case Against Kids, appears in this week's issue of the magazine. She's joining us today from her office in Williamstown, Massachusetts. And Elizabeth Colbert, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I guess let me ask you first, what got you started thinking about this? Just that there were a number of books you were noticing that were taking on the question?
Right, exactly. There just seemed to be a sort of constellation of books looking at this issue, as you suggest, from pretty different angles. Two of the books that I looked at were by professional, I guess I'll call them professional philosophers who teach philosophy, and one is by an economics professor who I guess is going to join you later.
Yeah. You raised the question of history. I wanted to go there first, if we could. You introduce readers to this character, this kind of eccentric doctor named Charles Knowlton, lived in Massachusetts in the 1830s, and for the time he had these kind of unconventional ideas about population.
Right. He has a really interesting story, which I kept bumping into, to be honest, not in the books that I reviewed, but just in books when I write a piece like that. I read a lot of books, and I read a lot of books about the history of thinking about reproduction, of thinking about birth control. And this guy named Charles Knowlton, who lived not far from where I live, as it happens, in the town of Ashfield, Massachusetts, which is a really tiny town in the Berkshires, he got the idea. He was a doctor, went to what is now Dartmouth Medical School, and he had the idea that we needn't procreate when we engage in what I believe he called the procreative act, that there were ways of intervening there. And he was very concerned about population growth. This was in the early part of the 19th century. Malthus had published his very famous essay on population about 30 years before, but it was a very, very live issue, and it was very population growth rates at the time in the U.S. were very, very high.
And he has so it's basically birth control that he's writing about. But it's interesting just what at least initially. Well, there are two things. It was such a scandal, but it was also such a hit.
Right, exactly. He was the story of his legal travails is sort of a real dark comedy, and he would get hauled into court as soon as it appeared. It was a very tiny little book, almost a pamphlet, really. As soon as it appeared, he was hauled into court, and he was convicted. But then a new edition came out, and they hauled him into court again, and this happened four times. Eventually, he was convicted twice, sentenced to pay a pretty large fine for the time and to 3 months of hard labor. But he kept on going, and then eventually his trial started to result in hung juries, and they sort of gave up prosecuting him.
Why do you figure? Just because the ideas made sense?
You know, I honestly don't know sort of what the legal status was, but I think that increasingly it was getting increasingly hard to get juries to convict him. He was being charged with obscenity, publishing obscenity. But I think there was a tremendous amount of interest in this little tract of his. And there's a wonderful quote from one of the jurors who tells him, "You know, I felt I had to convict you of the charges, but I want a copy of your book."
And you talk about how it really takes off. And in some ways, you say the book sort of changed the course of history.
Well, you know, it's a really interesting episode in American history and sort of in one of those episodes that's just been forgotten. But first of all, you have to, when you actually read the tract, which is a wonderfully antiquated document now, you have to wonder how effective the methodologies that he was suggesting.
Yeah.
He was really suggesting using, withdrawal. That was really the big one, which was a method of birth control, I should say. It might seem rather obvious, but that was actually pioneered by the French. And the French were the first country where birth rates really started to fall as a result of people consciously planning their families. And then it came to the States. He also had a very early... He also recommended a very early example of what I guess we would call a contraceptive sponge.
Yeah.
But it was really literally a sponge, And I don't know if anyone's ever done sort of tests. It's a test could have pretty serious repercussions if it fails as to how effective that could have been.
But I guess rather than whether they were practical or not, at least it raises the question of that children can be, I think, as you put it in the article, not a consequence, but they can sort of be it can be a choice.
Right. It was really when people at that general moment in time, whether because of him or because of the general advances in technology, very hard to tease these things out, where people started to recognize that, having children could be something that we could consciously decide to do or not to do. Irrespective of your sex life, and that was a huge change.
So, where do you figure? Where are we now in the conversation? And I think what's interesting is, even though you've written about this before, the article isn't about the question of the kind of the environmental implications of population. It's about the ethical questions that play into it.
Right, and the two philosophers who look at this question. What we will call overpopulation, what I will call overpopulation, has that we just recently hit 7 billion people last year, in the last couple of months. And as you pointed out, in another 13 years, we're expected to add 1 billion people. So we are adding population at an extremely rapid rate at this point. But their main focus for their work was not the question of population, but just if you examine this choice to bring another human being into the world, if you look at it from the perspective of many, many hundreds, thousands of years now of philosophy, what questions does that raise? And it raises some pretty provocative questions. How's that?
Let's start with Christine Overall, as you do in the article. She's written this book called "Why Have Children: The Ethical Debate." She's this philosophy professor, as you say. Her take is interesting because, at least initially, she kind of dismisses this idea that childbearing is natural.
Well, I should say I don't think she dismisses the idea that it's natural, but that's not a justification.
Right,
I mean,
say,
there are all sorts of primitive urges that humans have, which we wouldn't consider to be acceptable in 21st century society. So that she says that's just not enough of a reason. The fact that, we're evolutionarily sort of coded to reproduce ourselves is not a sufficient ethical justification for doing it.
What do you She sort of goes through these reasons that people offer for having children.
Right.
One of them, of course, is this idea that having a child benefits the child, that you bring a child into existence.
Right. And that is where, right away, things get pretty interesting because from her perspective, and it's a pretty, you know, compelling argument when you look at it from it, within a certain framework, how's that?
Yeah.
You know, you're choosing to bring someone into existence who would not otherwise exist. And non-existence, we don't really consider a harm. And, you know, when you just think of your own experience, right, I mean, all of us who are adults who have had kids or haven't had kids, either in either case, you presumably could have had more kids if you just kept pumping out kids, right? But you don't say to yourself, oh, I should have produced, you know, the maximum number of kids biologically possible, because we don't consider that child who was never born, we don't consider that child to have, that prospective hypothetical child, non-existent child, to have been harmed by not having been born.
She says once you accept the idea that that a baby will, you know, increase the world's total happiness, you come to what she calls, or you call, this repugnant conclusion. There's no, you can't really stop that once you get that started.
Right, and that's sort of based on, that's actually a term that was coined by a British philosopher named Derek Parfit, a pretty famous philosopher, and that is just extending the kind of basic utilitarian calculations to procreation, to having kids, and you reach this kind of, you know, a head in a vise kind of conclusion that if you consider, you know, any added increment of happiness in the world, so any, you know, kid who's born who has a moment of happiness, that's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
Then you are forced into this conclusion, as I sort of alluded to, that you should have every possible child that you could have, right? And none of us feels that that is, in fact, reasonable to expect us to do, or even an ethical thing to do, because of all of the other implications that are involved, including, you know, how are we going to support these kids? But if that kid were happy for, you know, overall, you know, had a even tiny bit of happiness in their life, it would increase the aggregate happiness of the world by that strict calculation.
What is this idea that parenthood makes you happy? This is an idea that overall sort of challenges.
Yes, and many people have challenged this idea. If you, if any of your listeners have read the book Stumbling on Happiness, he makes a very strong case based on other people's research that, you know, parenthood has never been shown. When all the research, you look at all the research, parenthood doesn't do very well in terms of self-reported happiness. Parents are not any more happy than non-parents. In fact, the evidence suggests they're slightly less happy.
Ultimately, what overall is, I guess, sort of concluding here is that if you're having a child to benefit yourself, this is a moral error. It all suggests there's a good reason?
Well, it's a really interesting point that you raise. She suggests that you shouldn't have a child, right, for the sake of this non-existent child. And you shouldn't have a child for yourself, right, because it's something that would make you happy, because that's not a reasonable reason to bring a person into this world.
Right.
So she's left in this really, you know, there's not much space there, right? You can't have the child for the sake of the child who hasn't been born, and you can't have the child for the sake of yourself. Nevertheless, she herself has children whom she, you know, calls the love of her life, and she ultimately comes down on this sort of, I would have to argue, somewhat fuzzy idea that you can have a child for the sake of creating this relationship. Now, I don't know exactly what that means. It was, I have to say, I thought it was a pretty weak conclusion of the book.
Right.
But she is someone who's not against having children. She does say that ethically she feels one shouldn't have more than two children because that is to replace yourself,
so
because of population pressures.
Whereas David Benatar, another one who's written, one of the professors, he's a professor at the University of Cape Town, also professor of philosophy, he seems to think, I guess, he says there really isn't a good reason.
Yeah, he sort of, I guess I would say, has the courage of his convictions, and yeah. he really puts a new sort of wins new awards for being down on the whole human race.
Right.
Like that. I'm going to infer that he himself has no children.
I thought so too.
And
he's,
yeah,
he almost would have not to have kids. I think
it certainly would. Be interesting if he did.
Yeah,
have that. I don't know enough about his background to tell you, but I'm gonna assume he doesn't. And he comes out with the pretty radical proposition that there's absolutely no ethical justification you can come up with for having kids. And when confronted with the idea that, you know, follow to its logical conclusion, that would mean that the whole human species would be extinct in relatively short order, he says, you know, great, that's a good thing.
Yeah. He sort of makes this argument based on this unappreciated asymmetry. Sort of, you want to explain? It's wonderfully complicated. Do you want to give it a shot?
Sure. His whole argument is based on a pretty interesting notion, which is that you do two little thought experiments, and in one case you say, let's just take a couple who's, you know, very well off, and they're healthy. And would you say that couple had an obligation to have kids? And this gets back to this idea: would they have an obligation to have a kid because that kid, you know, would experience some pleasure in life? And
yeah.
And you would say no, right? No one has an obligation to have a child.
Right.
And so that pleasure that won't be experienced by that child, that's not a harm. That gets back to this non-existence not being a harm. But if you took another couple and they had some kind of genetic condition, let's say, and we could predict that their child, if they had a child together, that child would, you know, be either terribly disabled or suffer in some grievous way, we would most of us would agree that that couple had an obligation not to have a child, not to bring that suffering into the world. So we would say they had an obligation, even though that suffering child doesn't yet exist.
Mm-hmm.
So he argues that on the basis of that asymmetry, everything that follows from that is bringing any kind of joy or pleasure into the world that wouldn't otherwise exist is not doing a good thing, right?
Yeah.
Because non-existence is not bad. But bringing any suffering into the world, which you inevitably do when you have a kid, right?
Yeah.
Because all of us suffer in life at some point, is a harm. So we are all bringing suffering into the world that's bad, whereas the pleasure we are bringing into the world by having kids, that doesn't count as a good. So that's his argument.
Well, here's how absolute it is, and you quote him in the article. He says, one of the implications of my argument is that a life filled with good and containing only the most minute quantity of bad, a life of utter bliss, adulterated only by the pain of a single pinprick, is worse than no life at all. I mean, that's
right.
How absolute he is.
That's why I say, as I say, he's a man who has the courage of his convictions.
Yeah.
He's willing to say something like that, which strikes most of us as, you know, kind of off the wall, to be honest.
Yeah, it's true. You know what? The thing that I found the most fascinating about Benatar's idea, though, is this notion that you talk about in the article that basically, evolution favors a kind of, as you put it, or he puts it, genetically encoded Pollyannaism.
Right. I mean, his reaction to what he knows, you know, he's not a complete lunatic. His reaction to what he knows are statements that are going to strike other people as loony. You know, this single pinprick outweighing a life of utter bliss.
Yeah.
That we are all products of a long, long line of people. Those people who chose not to reproduce or couldn't reproduce or whatever, they have, you know, they were an evolutionary dead end.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of our ancestors going back to the beginning of the species were people who did reproduce. And therefore, we are all sort of genetically brainwashed to believe in reproduction.
Let me ask you about Brian Kaplan. We'll hear from him in a moment, as you said. But what do you make of Kaplan's view, which is basically that, as you put it, parents sort of make the mistake of overvaluing the present?
Well, you know, it's an interesting argument. There are a lot of interesting arguments in his book. I think that a big premise of his book is that the reason parents find parenthood to be burdensome is because they actually believe they're influencing their kids. You know that a good upbringing makes a kid who's happy and, you know, smart and successful, and a bad upbringing makes one who's not. And he amasses all of these studies on twins. He has identical twins. As it happens, I have identical twins too. That suggests that it really doesn't matter. You know, you put a kid out there, and their genetics take over. Now, you know, it's some of its convincing arguments. I think that most people or parents are also going to have trouble believing that, even though everyone sees very strong genetic, you know, components to their children. I think most of us persist in believing that what we are doing is having some impact. How's that? And that it is a lot of work precisely because of that.
Yeah. You write in the article, if you follow Benatar's advice, it would sort of lead to extinction. If we follow Kaplan's advice, though, you say that would lead to this never-ending population boom. You seem conflicted about that. You seem to have some concerns about that, put it that
well,
way.
Yes. Well, Kaplan explicitly invokes an economist named Julian Simon, who was someone who argued that population growth at a time when many, many people were worried about population growth and still are, sort of for what are sometimes called neo-Malthusian reasons, because eventually the world will run out of resources. He argued, no, the world will never run out of resources, and people are a resource. Ideas are a resource, and the more people there are, the more ideas there are. And he very famously made a bet with Paul Ehrlich, who wrote The Population Bomb, sort of warning of the dangers of overpopulation. And Simon won that bet at the time. And so he really, his theories gained a lot of sort of credibility from that. But it should be pointed out that had the bet had a somewhat longer horizon, in fact, I just read a piece about that, by now he would be losing the bet, because in fact the price of resources is increasing, in part under population pressures. So the idea that we could just infinitely populate the planet and never run up against the limits of resources, I think I would argue is an idea that's very, very dangerous. But that's sort of the idea that Kaplan seems to be subscribing to. As I say, he does invoke Julian Simon as sort of one of his inspirations. So you should ask him about that.
Yeah, I will. Let me you've raised the question before of, you know, where the limit in human population lies, how many people can, you know, we support over the long term. And you've said in a piece you wrote in October, you know, the question remains open right now, but we need to get to some point where we're getting to an answer.
Well, the scary prospect to me, and I think, you know, to many, once again, I rely only on, you know, people who sort of do a lot of work in this field, is that we're intent on pushing up against that limit without having predetermined where it is. How's that? And we are doing it, you know, where's the first place that population pressures are going to, you know, really, really seriously be felt? Well, Malthus thought it was in food, and I think many people now feel it's going to be in food production, global food production. And the Green Revolution, which really astonishingly delivered these astonishing gains in food production that more or less kept pace with population growth through the last couple of decades, have really slowed down, and we're facing a time when also water resources, when we're going to be trying to grow more food in a changing climate, and those are things to be, I think, pretty, pretty concerned about at this point.
Elizabeth Colbert, she is an environmental journalist, the staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. Her piece, The Case Against Kid, appears in this week's issue of The New Yorker. She joined us from her home in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Elizabeth, thanks again.
Oh, thanks for having me.
801-585-WEST, the number to join us if you like, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the ethics of population growth. The environmental journalist Elizabeth Culbert has an article in the latest New Yorker magazine which explores the arguments for and against having kids. We're talking about that debate today, and we invite you to join us if you like. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us now on the program is Brian Kaplan, a professor of economics at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. He's the author of the book Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids, Why Being a Great Parent is Less Work and More Fun Than You Think. And Brian Kaplan is joining us today from a studio in at George Mason. Brian Kaplan, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I wanted to begin by, I guess, getting your impression of the way Elizabeth Culbert portrayed your concept in your idea. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I thought overall it was extremely fair. I'm totally pleased.
What got you thinking about all of this? I mean, you've written about the fact that you've been thinking about this a long time, but I guess what really, at least partially, motivated you was the news that your wife was giving birth to twins.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So I was interested in twin research and adoption research just as a matter of curiosity. But then, just by total coincidence, we wound up having identical twins. And when I was raising these twins, it was a daily reminder, wow, there's a whole body of research where they study people like my kids to understand why people turn out the way they do. And the usual finding is that parents just have a lot less long-run influence over how their kids turn out than is widely believed. And I realized, wait, so this actually means that I don't have that much effect on my kids' long-run outcomes, so how should I be raising them? The conclusion I drew is, well, I should be focusing on enjoying our time together rather than trying to turn them into my idea of what a perfect person would be.
I wondered, why do people have children? I know that sounds like such a basic question, but have you found any insights to that question in your research?
Well, I mean, I think in the previous discussion you were just mentioning evolution, I think there's a lot to that. Evolution has weeded out people who don't find the idea of having kids appealing. A lot of what goes on is people, people I think are lonely. They have some desire to create an extension of themselves, and by having kids, that's part of what they accomplish. Some people will say that they think that having kids will make them happier.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a more common or more nuanced view is it gives their life additional meaning. It's not so much a matter of like having a big party as feeling like you've accomplished something really worthwhile with your life. So I think that's a big part of it. Another thing, this is felt more often by women than men, but although I definitely experience this, is what people call baby hunger. Mm. Right? It's just a feeling of, I want a baby, I want a baby, I want a baby. So a pretty high percentage of women in their 20s and especially their 30s will say they have a lot of this. It's rarer for men to say it, although I'll say I feel it. And by the way, I'm having my fourth child in less than 2 weeks.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
So your reason... Huh. So it's partly biological, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I
guess we don't understand it very well in some ways, that need. I mean, we can say it's genetic, but there's something else going on, it seems like, too.
Right. Well, I would say we understand it as well as our desire to have friends or desire to find a romantic partner or desire to find meaningful work. I mean, these are all things where they're pretty basic human desires. If you keep asking why that, eventually a person will be tongue-tied and feel like they don't have an answer. But I wouldn't say that we understand less well than a lot of other very basic things in people's lives.
Yeah. Let's talk about the broad focus of the book, and then we'll get to some particulars. I mean, the heart of the argument is that there's this connection between how you raise your kids and how many kids are best for you to have.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And you say that when people consider children, I mean, one of the things they think about is that, look, if I'm going to get this right, it's going to take years and years of sacrifices and a lot of kind of unpleasant sacrifices. But it seems like you challenge this idea that the sense of sacrifice is that we're misreading it.
That's right.
Is that right?
So certainly, for any child, there's always some sacrifice. There's always something you have to give. I always man the night shifts whenever we have new kids. So I just stay up all night for a couple months and sleep during the day. As a professor, I have that option. But still, what I say is that there's a lot of unnecessary sacrifice. There's a lot of stuff that people do in their own minds for their kids' sake or if you really look at the evidence, it's not actually helping the child in the long run, or actually often is making them miserable in the short run and accomplishing little in the long run, except maybe messing up your relationship. I had the good fortune that Amy Chua, the Tiger Mother's book, came out just a couple months before mine.
Right.
Right. So she has this whole philosophy of forcing her kids to study piano or violin for several hours a day from a very early age. It's not that she wants them to turn into professional musicians. She seems to have some theory that if you study a musical instrument for all these years, it'll make you a big success in life. Never mind that she didn't do that and she's a professor at Yale. Yeah. Never mind that her husband was raised by a hippie mom and he's also a professor at Yale. Nevertheless, this very strong view, which often seems to be impervious to the evidence, that if you just go and ride your kid really hard, exert all this parenting effort, this will work wonders. As I say, if you look at the actual evidence, the most meaningful effect parents do have on their kids' long run future is just how the kid feels about and remembers you. You do have a pretty big effect on your child's appreciation. If you raise the child with kindness, with love, you do things, your child's quite likely to remember that, and you're going to have a good relationship with that kid. So I think about parents like Amy Chua, they're not actually turning their kids into successes. Again, children will often be successes anyway, but it's not that the piano lessons cause their great success, but their kids are likely to have a Darth Vader ringtone on their cell phone for their mom when they're adults.
Right. It seems like – so if Amy's on one end of the continuum, you don't necessarily want to be on the other end, right? You're not saying do nothing. You're just saying it's
– focus on doing things with your kids that you enjoy.
Yeah.
I mean, people often, a common reaction to research on twins and adoptions is to say, so it doesn't matter how I raise my kids. And I'd say, this is not original to me. This other writer, Judith Harris, says, well, you could just as easily say it doesn't matter how you treat your spouse. Of course it matters. But it doesn't matter that if you treat your spouse a certain way, that's going to turn that spouse into a totally different kind of person. Mm. If you get married thinking you're going to change your spouse, you are probably wrong and you're going to be very disappointed and it's going to end badly. And really, we should think about our relationships with our kids as being a lot like our relationships with other people. It's not about treating them like a science project. It's about enjoying the journey together, finding things that you enjoy, having some fun together. Of course, being a parent is also about taking care of them. And there are plenty of very basic things that are important for parents to do. Make sure they actually go to school.
Right.
But nevertheless, the idea that if you're a parent who just doesn't put in who tries to avoid, if possible, unpleasant parts of the experience, you're not really hurting your kid. You're making yourself happier. And I think in many ways, you being happier actually is better for your kids. There was something that I learned about when writing the book. There's something called the Ask the Children survey, where they actually asked kids to grade their parents. So it was interesting. So parents assume that kids would say they wanted more time with their parents, but this is a very rare, very, very rare view for kids to have. Much more common for kids to say they wish their parents were less angry and stressed. And so clearly there's a lot of parents who are pretty frustrated with their lives, and a lot of it had to do with the many sacrifices they make for their kids, and then they take it out on their kids in moments of weakness. It's sad.
Well, that's part of the thing that seems like motivated the book. I mean, because this isn't just some philosophical discussion about the ethics of population. I mean, in some ways it's about how you can improve the experience of parenting for people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very striking to me. So, there's all this research on what are the long-run effects of parenting on kids, saying it's not very much, in which case, well, if the long-run effect isn't very much, we should really focus on day-to-day.
Yeah.
We should really just focus on the quality of the experience today. But if you look at it that way, then you just get a very different view of parenting. It's not about riding your kids that one day you'll be a success and he'll thank you later, maybe. It's about saying, this is another person here. I care about him, and what do we have in common? What do we enjoy doing together? That's what I do with each of my kids. I just try to find out, what is this kid interested in? A lot of it just depends upon age. So my 2-year-old wants to go to the park. He doesn't want to sit around and read a book that much. But still, I'm often looking for the kid's a little bit older. Is there something else that he might find fun? And honestly, when I take my kids places, I often think, well, so what will I do while we're there? If he's going to run around, will I want to run around there too, or can I just go and enjoy the walk, or what else can I do? Let's find something that we all enjoy.
We were talking with Elizabeth Colbert about this happiness research that one of the authors of this book mentioned, that people with kids actually tend to be less happy. I mean, you've seen these studies. You say there's kind of more to it than that.
Yeah, that's right. It definitely is true that parents are a little bit less happy than people who are otherwise very similar. So that holds up very well. However, people often then exaggerate this into parents are miserable, which is totally false. It's a very slight effect. I mean, just to get an idea, just to get a measure for comparison, if you go and take the empirical work literally, it says, you know, says that the positive effect of marriage on happiness is so large that people who are married and have about 10 kids are about as happy as people who are single without kids. Now, you might look at that and say, fine, I'll get married and won't have kids. That's possible. But, you know, it's striking that when you take a look at this research, very few people look at it and say this is a call for marriage. Everyone ought to get married because married people are so much happier than single people. They're much more likely to find this much smaller effect of kids on happiness. Now, what I also say is, people often cite this evidence as saying that I'm wrong. I say, no, this is the inspiration for the book. If parents were super happy already, I wouldn't really need to write this book. You know, I'm writing this book in large part because I see a lot of parents are needlessly unhappy. There's a lot of ways they can improve their lives without hurting their kids, and I just want to let them know, hey, this is not just something I'm making up. It's not just my opinion. There are 40 years worth of studies on twins and adoptees saying that you really don't have that much long-run effect on your kids, and this is good news because it means that you can enjoy your lives together.
801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Let's take a call or two. John is joining us in Chicago, Illinois. John, welcome.
I just thought when I was raising my children that my main problem was that I'm teaching them every lesson they learn, except I don't get to pick which ones stick.
Right.
It's the kids that pick. So it could be the offhand comment rather than the sit-down serious discussion that they take the lesson from.
Brian Kaplan, what do you think?
I mean, it's totally possible. I mean, one way that you can look at the research is that parents just don't have much effect. Another possibility is sometimes parents have the effect they want and sometimes it backfires and has the opposite effect. It's pretty hard to sort that out. You know, so for example, when you just take a look and see that kids who are adopted by overweight parents don't grow up to be overweight. All right. So you could look at that and say, well, maybe what's going on is that the weight of the people around you or their eating habits doesn't have any effect on you. Maybe on the other hand, there's some who buy into the way their adoptive family eats, and there's some who are so horrified that they say, I'm never going to be like that. So that's possible. Although from a practical standpoint, it doesn't matter that much to say, well, look, either I'm not changing my child very much, or what I'm doing will either do what I want or the opposite. Either way, as a practical matter, it's like, well, it doesn't seem like it's a very good reason to push if there's a good chance it's backfiring, if it's working at all.
Mm. John, thanks. 801-585-WEST, again, that number. Kevin is with us in Salt Lake. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Sure.
This is a very interesting topic. I'm a 52-year-old man who has never been married, never had kids, never wanted to have kids, and it's the whole idea that, particularly also living in Utah, where when you make that decision, you really look down upon.
Yeah.
And I recently had this conversation with my girlfriend who has kids, and it's the whole idea about why. Why would I ever make that decision, and why don't you want to participate? And I have these kids. Why aren't you there for them? That's basically my comment.
Yeah. Brian Kaplan, how do you respond to something like that? You hear that all the time, of course, people reacting. Mm-hmm. They don't want them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, strangely enough, the angriest complaints that I've got about my book are from people who are voluntarily childless. And really what I've told them many times is, look, I have nothing against you. You live your life. I live my life. I'm not here to try to ride anyone or nag anyone. All I want to say is that for the vast majority of the population that does have some interest in having kids, there's a better way of doing it. If you just don't like the idea, I'm the last person on earth to pester you about it.
Yeah, you're not saying it's a duty or you should, or you're just saying for those who make the choice, there's a reason not to be so stressed out. And here's the other thing which I wanted to ask you about. You say parents are overcharging themselves for their kids, that they should stock up, I think is how you put it.
Yeah, what I say is, you know, like if you believe that the only way that a child becomes a decent adult is through massive parental suffering, nagging, pushing, dragging them to lessons they don't want to go to, then the thought of another kid is pretty scary because it's like 18 more years of being the bad guy, 18 more years of leaning on some other person, and then who knows what the experience is actually going to be. But I say, look, you know, the actual evidence is the suffering that parents are making really doesn't have the effects they think that it does. In fact, in many ways, it backfires. So, you know, like the first sensible thing to do is just stop suffering that doesn't actually really accomplish anything constructive. But then I go further and I say, once you realize that you can be a very good parent without doing a lot of the stuff that the tiger moms are doing, then you should also say maybe another kid would actually be a good idea. You know, if I raise my kids the way that a lot of parents that I know raise them, where there really is just a lot of nagging, a lot of pushing, a lot of dragging them to classes they don't want to go to, I wouldn't want to have four kids.
Yeah.
You know, I'm interested in having four kids because I find great joy in it. I'm not here sitting around being the bad guy. Of course, you know, there is discipline, but it's not. I'm not just trying to exert my power on them in order to turn them into a piano virtuoso or something like that. There's got to be basic civilized behavior that's expected. And again, really, you know, when I think about discipline, I mostly think about it. It's for the convenience of the people that deal with the child, including the parents. It's not that when you discipline your kid, you're keeping them out of jail. They're probably going to learn not to hit people anyway, even if you don't tell them that as a parent. The real question there is just like what does it take to turn your child into a decent roommate during the years when you were under the same roof?
Right. So this is about the here and now.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the long run, the main thing I think about is what is this doing to the relationship that we're going to have with your kids when you're an adult? And there again, there's some very interesting twin evidence. For example, there's a study of Swedish twins, some raised together, some raised apart. The main result was that if you're raised together, you have pretty similar views about what your parents are like, about whether they're kind, whether they spent time with you. If you're raised apart, there still is some genetic element. There's some tendency for people to see their parents similarly, even when clearly they're not, because they're different people.
Yeah.
But still, there is a pretty substantial effect of the way that you raise your kids on how they will see you and also how they'll remember you. And this is a very long-lasting effect. Some of the twins in the study were, I think, into their 70s, maybe their 80s. So, I mean, there really is a sense in which the way that you raise your children stays with them for a lifetime. But it's not the piano lessons. It's the time that you took them canoeing or played a game with them.
Let's go back to the phones. Thanks, by the way, Kevin. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Let's see. Scott is with us in Salt Lake. Scott, welcome.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have five children, and my wife and I, when we were new parents, we had this idea, probably incorrect, that we had to teach our children, not necessarily knowing what that meant. And when they were very young, we focused on a lot of rules and a lot of discipline, and that caused a lot of suffering for us as parents because it never really worked. And at some point in our journey, we decided that we could spend more time just being with our children than teaching them. And when we spent time being with our children and developing relationships with them, the situation ended up becoming much more positive than focusing on trying to teach them or instill rules.
Brian Kaplan, that sort of gets at what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. Of course, you know, the painfulness of teaching depends upon the person. There's some people who really love being taught, and there's others who don't want to be. It's like, you know, my older two sons enjoy lectures, although I wait to find that they're actually interested in a subject before I'll go and tell them about it. But yeah, that's exactly right. There's a lot of parents who just look at their child and say, like, how is he ever going to become an adult unless I tell him what to do?
Yeah.
The truth is, like, you know, human beings figure this stuff out. It's like, you know, your child could have been raised by a very different family, still would have figured it out. A lot of the things that we learn from other kids, learn from just looking around in our society. And so, and on the other hand, you know, there's really only one chance, one person who can be the parent of that child. You know, that's you. So, like you have such a big effect on what kind of relationship that is, whether it's full of conflict and bad feelings or whether it's something that where the child can look back and say, wow, you know, like, what a great woman my mom was.
Yeah. It really seems you are up against this really powerful cultural impulse that we have this powerful influence on our kids. And you're saying something that goes against that. There must be some sort of kind of instinctive reaction against the idea in some way.
Oh, yeah. And I think it's not just instincts. It's also firsthand experience.
Yeah.
Because here's the thing. There's a very big difference between the short-run effects of parenting and the long-run effects. The short-run effects are very real. There's plenty of experiments that involve raising your child in one way versus another and seeing what happens. Again, you know, nothing extreme, or else we wouldn't be doing these experiments on humans. But, you know, the experiments with discipline, things like that. And the main result is, you know, like, you know, in the very short run, you see an effect. You don't even need to do an experiment in a lab. You can just see what happens if you tell your kid to stop doing something. Generally, the kid will stop but the question is for how long? Right, so you go and tell your kid, you know, like, don't try stealing cookies behind my back. How long does it actually last? I mean, 5 minutes, a day, a week, a month. In order to actually find out what the long run effect is, you can't just look at your firsthand experience. You need to go and look at something like a Twinner adoption study that really sorts out nature from nurture over a long period. And the result there is that the short run effects of parenting, the long run effects are very different. Very, very different indeed. You can see this for things like church attendance, where when people are very young, you can still see a pretty big effect on how much they attend church based upon how they're raised. But by the time they're in their 30s, you don't see it anymore. There is, of course, a tendency for church going to run in families, but the reason seems to be genetics in the long run. It's that there's a certain kind of person who feels spiritual. There's a genetic component to that. If you have kids, there's a high likelihood they'll have it too. And then when they're in their 30s, they'll be going to church and saying it's because of their upbringing. Not true.
Mm. Scott, thanks very much for the call. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Tim in Cedar City, call back. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Brian Kaplan with us, a professor of economics at George Mason University. He's the author of Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids, Why Being a Great Parent is Less Work and More Fun Than You Think. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the ethics of population growth. Joining us now on the program, Brian Kaplan. He's the author of Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids, Why Being a Great Parent is Less Work and More Fun Than You Think. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Tim is with us in Cedar City. Tim, welcome.
Hi. I was just listening to this, and I was trying to think of how you would even have a conversation with somebody from, China, India, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the pictures we see. I live in southern Utah, one of the least populated places on the planet. And I'm thinking, you know, what discussion do you have with somebody in India who doesn't have as much water of either quality or quantity that I use to flush my toilet? And my lawn would be a paradise for them. And so, I mean, this seems all kind of, We don't even seem to occupy the same planet with billions of people. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, Brian Kaplan, it raises thanks very much, Tim, by the way. Let me see if I can work through it. I mean, it does raise one of the questions that Elizabeth Colbert was talking about, and that is the effect of fertility on the environment. And I expect you're going to get plenty of the arguments. You say the effect of fertility on the environment is mixed. Mm-hmm. You talk about the fact that we're not, in fact, running out of food and fuel and minerals. And you talk about how air and water quality have improved.
Mm-hmm. Wow, you really read the book.
But Elizabeth Colbert, of course, says, you know, look, there's some questions here about whether, in fact, food production is slowing, concerns for water. And, of course, there's global climate change, which you, of course, acknowledge. But respond to that, if you would.
Right. So the main thing is that people look at population and they tend to see only the negatives. What I say is a lot of these negatives are overstated. Some of them are real, but it's very rare that people acknowledge the positives. So Colbert actually did go and talk about some of the main positives, but they really are worth dwelling on. I mean, here, if you think about the world as having a fixed pie of resources. And the more people there are, the less each person's going to get, which is a very common way of thinking about it. The last 200 years of world history is completely mysterious because, it is literally true that we have the largest population in human history. We also have the highest standard of living for the world in human history. This is what we're seeing right now. There has been an amazing increase in not just the total number of people, but the living standards that the average person enjoys. Not just the average person in the first world, the average person anywhere on Earth. You might just say it's coincidence we've gotten lucky, but there is a pretty good story about why this is not so surprising at all, why there very well might be a way that rising population causes rising prosperity. So I'm an economics professor, a very standard view in the people who study economic growth. is that the main reason we're richer than the past is just that we know more than we know in the past. We know how to make an iPod. We know how to make a flying machine. The resources that we use were always here, but people 200 years ago or 1,000 years ago didn't know how to actually turn those resources into the amazing standard of life that we have. So once you admit that ideas are crucial for standard of living, then you can start asking, well, where do these ideas come from? And a very big part of the answer is comes from population. Areas of the world that have large populations generally contribute a larger share of ideas. You can take a look at this over time and just see in periods with a lot more people, there's a lot more ideas. Or you can also just look at it by parts of the world. Like almost all progress in human history has come from Eurasia, an area of the world where there's a large connected population. On the other hand, isolated areas don't create many ideas. Tasmania, I talk a bit about in the book. Tasmania, until Europeans came there, when Europeans arrived in Tasmania, they found a bunch of people on an island without any boats. You wonder, how do people live on an island without any boats? Eventually, they realized that they walked there many thousands of years earlier when sea levels were lower. And then the sea levels rose and they didn't have any boats. And Tasmania, with just a few thousand people, it was a completely stagnant civilization. They actually seemed to lose technology over time. Like they lost the fish hook. They had it once and then they lost it. Realize that ideas do come from people, more people means more ideas. And the wonder of an idea is it can be enjoyed by billions of people. One person figures out how to make an iPhone. Of course, that's actually the case. A lot of people have to come together to do it. But still, and then billions of people will eventually benefit from this technology.
It's Brian Kaplan. He's a professor of economics at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, the author of the book Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids, Why Being a Great Parent is Less Work and More Fun Than You Think. He joined us from a studio there at George Mason. Professor Kaplan, thanks.
Thanks so much. It was a great pleasure.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Our thanks to Olivia Davis and Matthew Martin. The show directed today by Michael Havey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.